Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, May 21st, 2019. The leader of an opposition party says there is no reason to give more time for pre-transitional activities.
The only option is to take peace as their own, to own it, and then try to pressurize the leadership in order to implement peace agreement, letter and spirit, because the people of South Sudan have really suffered.
And residents of Wau Town say army-civilian relations are getting a little bit better.
Nowadays, army and civilians are able to move hand in hand and they intermingle together in the marketplaces. They are no longer moved with their guns.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus on 21st May 2019. The leader of the Democratic Change Party says the partners to the peace agreement, if the partners to the peace agreement fail to complete the pre-transitional activities by November deadline, South Sudanese should own the agreement and force their leaders to carry out the terms of the revitalized peace deal. Onyoti Adigo says delaying the formation of the transitional government of national unity for 6 months will not solve anything. Dimo Silva Aurelio has this report for VOA from Juba.
Democratic Change Party leader Onyoti Adigo, who is also South Sudan's agriculture and food security minister, says the people have suffered enough. He says President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar could have used their recent visit with Pope Francis in Rome as a chance to unite and form a unity government by May 12. Adigo says if the 6 months extension lapses without peace being restored, South Sudanese will have only one option.
The only option is to take peace as their own, to own it, and then try to pressurize the leadership in order to implement peace agreement, letter and spirit, because the people of South Sudan have really suffered, and we are trying to say enough is enough.
Adigo made his remarks today while opening an extraordinary National Delegates Congress aimed at uniting his fragmented Democratic Change Party in Juba. Speaking in Arabic at the same event, David William, a member of the umbrella opposition group, the National Alliance, says South Sudan's leaders have one last opportunity to implement the deal.
This is the last chance. We have to be serious. We have to be serious about the international community.
This is the last chance, and we must be serious before our people and the international community. In these 6 months, if there is any outstanding issue on security arrangements or IBC, they must finish it this period and form a new government. We don't want any further extension again. South Sudan can't be ruled on transitional and interim periods. There must be something permanent.
Professor Peter Aduok Nyaba, who attended the Congress, says the culture of violence is deeply rooted in the minds of South Sudanese.
The biggest problem which has caused all this in which we see is war and so on, poverty and ignorance. Poverty and ignorance is the fundamental problem because of the long time of political exclusion, economic neglect, and marginalization and social discrimination. That's why we have always resorted to fighting.
Gabriel Changson Chang, Deputy Chairman of the National Pre-Transitional Committee, or NPTC, and leader of the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, says the NPTC has made progress in implementing security sector pre-transitional activities.
We have released money to the security sector committees, the JDB, the JMCC, the JTSC, the SDSR, to start their work so that we are not caught up by time.
Chang says the government has not yet released the $100 million in pledge for implementing pre-transitional activities. He says he hopes the money is dispersed in the next few weeks so security arrangements can move forward.
The president has to fulfill his obligation. What is that obligation? To make funds available. for these activities to be worked out. And he has made that pledge. We hope before the end of this week that 100 million that has been pledged, at least part of it will be in the accounts of NPTC.
Adigo admits his Democratic Change Party fragmented after its former leader and founder, Lam Akol, resigned in 2016 after fighting flared between government forces and Riek Machar's bodyguards in Juba.
The Democratic Change Party had undergone upheaval in the struggle for power from within, and it is only through this delegate congress that we can arrive at a solution to bring back our party to its momentum in unity.
Party members from across the country gathered at a Juba hotel to attend their congress and resolve the party's internal wrangles. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Still in Juba, civil society activists called off the launch of a new report on the implementation of South Sudan's peace agreement. David Jame Kolok is a member of the South Sudan Civil Society Task Force. He says the group applied to the National Security for permission to launch the report. Jame says the National Security did not give a green light for the release of the report on progress in the implementing the revitalized peace agreement.
Today, we are supposed to be launching our report, which basically covers the transitional period. And it is under that basis that we have to cancel the event because we couldn't timely secure approval from the national security.
Why did you not get approval from the national security? Did you apply? Did you inform them that you were supposed to launch your report today?
We all know that it has been a practice in South Sudan that when you are organizing any event, you must notify the national security. From last week, we engaged one of our member organizations to apply and notify them of the launching of this report. What happened is that, of course, this afternoon, we were anticipating that the event was going to happen. Unfortunately, we received a call that was actually asking whether we were going ahead to launch the report. And we said, no, we couldn't go ahead simply because we did not get the approval. And we ended up canceling the event because it was coming late.
What are your findings in during this pre-transitional period?
The report has provided a balanced perspective of what exactly happened right from the signing of the agreement through the pre-transitional period. Of course, we started by acknowledging the fact that unlike the 2015 agreement, there seems to be some signs of progress and commitment by the parties towards the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement. And that through this commitment, we have seen some progress in terms of establishment of mechanisms and institutions that are intended to support the implementation of the peace agreement. And in this institution, we also recognize the fact that civil society and academia have been part of that process.
Some of the findings and some of your recommendations. One recommendation was that the National Pre-Transitional Committee should be transparent in its financial dealings. Why would you give such recommendations?
Yeah, but I think the question of resources that is intended to support the peace implementation process has always been an issue. I think from day one, we have had statements from both the parties in regards to their challenges towards the implementation of the peace agreement. Now, we are grateful that while the extension was being done, there is a promise by the government to sponsor some of the activities required during the extension of up to tune of about 100 million. And we are simply saying that, yes, that is a very positive step. However, we need a very clear framework, and we need clear budget lines in terms of what that amount of money is going to be used for.
This revitalized peace agreement has its own issues and its own shortcomings. I did not see some of your recommendations on the weaknesses of this agreement. Is that deliberate?
We acknowledge that the bottom line is that we have got an agreement and that the parties have committed themselves to implementing the provisions of that agreement, regardless of the shortcomings. Now, one thing, Tanzania, which I want to tell you is that I think as South Sudanese, we shouldn't attach the success of our peace agreement necessarily to the agreement. We have always said as civil society, if you have the political will to bring peace, you can even bring peace without this peace agreement. So the question of some gaps identified in the peace agreement, to me, to ask a civil society, is not really an issue.
But not all the parties are on board. Some parties are still sitting on the fence, and that is a recipe for a return to violence or conflict, if you like. Do you agree with me on that?
Yes, I agree. Totally, I agree. And that is why civil society has always said that there should be a room for inclusion of non-signatories, because they have got potential to disrupt the peace agreement. And we are also telling Israel and the international partners that I think it is high time to ensure that the language that we use as a way of bringing other parties on board should be a language that enhances negotiation, not a language that enhances antagonism. So we recognize the fact that it is very critical that I give our message to this parties that have not signed the peace agreement, is that I think the best option for them to continue moving toward this process is a non-violent option.
That's David Jammeh Kolok, Executive Director of the Foundation for Democracy and Accountable Governance, a member organization of the Peace Implementation Monitoring Initiative. He was speaking with me from Nairobi earlier today, and we apologize for that poor telephone line quality. Some residents of Wau Town say the relationship between the army and civilians have improved in the area over the past few months due to steady confidence-building efforts. Many civilians say they no longer fear men in military uniform like they did in 2016. But residents are also urging the government to pay soldiers their salaries on time so they don't resort to looting and beating people. Michael Atit has the story for VOA from Wau.
Relations between the army and Wau civilians deteriorated in 2016 when violence broke out in the area, forcing thousands to flee to churches, UN compounds, or rural areas. Civilians accused some soldiers of looting property, harassment, and even killing civilians. Army officials accused some civilians of supporting the armed opposition. Non-governmental organizations have organized forums over the past few years to try to improve relations between Wau civilians and organized forces. Speaking at Wau Forum today on the status of civilian-military relations, some citizens said things are better, adding, it is not unusual to see soldiers and civilians speaking face-to-face, shopping together, or even traveling together. Speaking in Arabic, Sarah Joseph Kigo, who resides in Wau's Lokloko neighborhood, says civilians no longer fear the army because most soldiers no longer carry guns.
Nowadays, army and civilians are able to move hand in hand and they intermingle together in the marketplaces. They are no longer move with their guns. That shows that their commanders are implementing what we have been telling them, to keep all their guns in the store.
Ambelia Mario Safu, who resides in Wau's Jebel Khair neighborhood, one of the hardest hit areas by the fighting, says, unlike in the past, now she regularly visits her garden outside the town without fear. Speaking in Arabic, Mario says soldiers probably loot civilian property because they are poorly paid.
Jesh mindu akil, mindu gurush, uwa insan.
Soldiers do not have food, they don't have money, they are human and they need to provide for their children. Even they need to eat and drink. They also need to live as normal people, but they cannot afford that.
Both Mario and Kigo say more must be done to educate South Sudanese about respecting the law. Major Salva Mathok is the head of Child Protection Services in the Wau-based 5th Division of the South Sudan People's Defense Forces. He says reuniting more than 20 child soldiers with their families contributed positively towards improving relations between civilians and the army.
We screen almost 22 children from a mechanized division, which was based in Mapel, and we handle them to the UNICEF. UNICEF is the one responsible for those children which are associated with the army to arrange their screening and also to arrange for the reunification of these children to their families.
Colonel Awan Deng Amom, the head of morale orientation at the SSPDF's 5th Division, agrees that the army must reform its image. He says the army will continue to engage with civilians and NGOs as the government works to reform the institution of the army.
There will be a great training of soldiers, officers, NCOs and men, so that they know their function. Like what we do now, we just train them about constitution, also the laws of the army and some other laws. Even that is why now we attend all the workshop, always so that our relationship is normalized with civilians.
Stephen Robo Musa, Community Empowerment for Progress Organization, or SEPO's regional director, says 3 years of working with the army and civilians has produced positive results.
The army have understood that the civilians are not their real enemy, but they are more than people that need their protection. And also they are concerned about their rights as well. So that, for me, that ownership, it really can bring more sustainability of peace and also security, stability of security in the state.
The workshop between civilians and soldiers are being facilitated by SEPO with support from Safer World. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, we take a look at the fight to control the spread of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That story is coming up after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you spend your day off from work?
My day off, which is normal a Sunday anyway, personally, I go to church, go back home, do my laundry, watch a movie or soccer. I think basically that's my routine.
I do laundry in the morning. I love traveling and I love swimming. Sometimes I go for swimming, sometimes I go for shopping, sometimes I party with friends. You know, that's that day I get free to be around friends.
Reading some novels and also sometimes doing my personal cleaning.
Hang with the family members, relax your mind and forget about the work or something. I just relax. I basically sleep it off because you'll be tired.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America, and it's time for our Tuesday Health segment. Today, we are talking about the fight to control Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo. A panel of World Health Organization experts say strategies must be strengthened to combat the worsening Ebola epidemic in the neighboring Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. The WHO's latest report counted 1,738 cases of Ebola in Congo, including 1,218 deaths. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO annual conference in Geneva.
Congo's Minister of Health, Ole Ilungo, likens the Ebola epidemic to a multi-headed dragon. Speaking through an interpreter, he says the epidemic began in one place, Mangina, but keeps popping up elsewhere.
Our response therefore, needs to continually adapt itself to the situation. We need to continually adapt and change our strategy, bearing in mind lessons learned.
Ilungo says prevention measures, surveillance, the tracing of infected people, timely treatment and safe burial practices must be maintained. At the same time, he says all tools need to be refreshed and improved. He proposes setting up a data-driven system which compiles all the information produced in the response effort.
Increasingly, we managed to carry out analyses that allow us to get ahead of the problem. And we can identify the danger areas where there might be a greater risk of the virus spreading, and we can get ahead of the problem.
The WHO Regional Director for Africa, Machidiso Moeti, finds the increasing number of new Ebola cases extremely worrying and challenging. She warns the risk of the disease spreading beyond Congo's borders is very high. She says the DRC's 9 neighboring countries are aware of the dangers and, with the help of the WHO, have taken many steps to prepare for that possibility.
We have 16 Ebola treatment centers and units having been established across the 9 countries. And in addition, over 4,500 health workers have been trained to be able to detect and manage Ebola cases. The countries have continued to engage with communities to raise their awareness in all high-risk areas.
WHO officials are appealing for intensified international political engagement and financial support to combat Ebola. They warn the further spread of the dangerous disease would have serious social and economic regional implications and would trigger an even greater crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
From Geneva, we move to Khartoum, where talks between Sudan's ruling Transitional Military Council and an alliance of protesters and opposition groups failed for the second day in a row due to a deadlock. The Transitional Military Council, the Declaration of Freedom and Change Forces, an umbrella of protesters and opposition groups, have agreed on a 3-year transition before elections, but there is a deadlock over who should hold ultimate power. Nabil Najem is a political analyst in Cairo. He spoke to VOA's senior analyst Mohammed El-Ashenawi about the reasons behind the deadlock.
Actually, it is quite a normal situation, you know. After 3 decades of suppression and dividing the society, Sudan, as I have seen it 2 days ago, it is a quite distorted state. President Omar al-Bashir has managed to destroy the public servant sector, the army, the police, most of the country's fundamental backbone. Now, after such 30 years of suppression, you get a lot of steam coming out. And it is quite natural that people are not up to the statehood level. And I find the situation in Sudan alarming.
But why the military is insisting to have more representation in the council?
From the military, the TMC, the Transitional Military Council's point of view, that they are not sure that the other side, the DFCF, the Declaration of Freedom and Change, is quite ready or up to the mission. So they want to have the upper hand in the situation. On the other hand, the civilian body, FCF, is calling such attitude as a way to sustain the military rule in Sudan. And some of them go far to describe it as a coup against a coup. I find it a way to minimize the differences. And maybe by middle of next week, they're going to get together to a middle point to save Sudan out of the unknown.
So would the pressure from the African Union produce a solution that meets the protesters' demand to have a civilian transitional government? Or would the military be able to use security as an excuse for their continued grip on power?
To be honest with you, I find the AU influence is not useful at this moment. So USA, EU, and the Gulf States, their efforts to be coordinated with Egypt should get involved and tell Sudanese people, listen, you are not alone. We're going to support the state, and we're going to save it from slipping into what Libya is going through and Yemen.
That's Nabil Najem, a political analyst in Cairo. He spoke to VOA's senior analyst Mohammed El-Ashenawi. The High Court in Kenya is set to rule Friday on a case challenging colonial laws that criminalize homosexuality. The petitioners want the court to declare those laws unconstitutional in hopes that life will become easier for the country's gay, lesbian, bisexual and transgender community. Rahel Ombur reports for VOA from Nairobi.
Stanley Mwasa, a gay man living in Kenya, says going to parties or events alone is always a risky affair. It is safer if he's in a group of two or three people, he says. In the past, he has been attacked by strangers, an experience shared by many gay and lesbians in Kenya, he says. He is hoping that on Friday, Kenya's High Court will overturn the law that he says has fueled homophobia for decades. The law he refers to are the sections of the Penal Code that make gay sex a crime.
There is no way someone is going to traumatize you, yet you have a right to go to any police station or any facility that gives justice. But it will change. Everything will change. Even the police officers, the way they carry KPs, it will have to change.
In 2016, three Kenyan gay rights organizations filed petitions with the High Court asking it to declare sections 162A and C and sections 165 of the Penal Code unconstitutional. The organizations argue the laws violate the rights to privacy, the rights to freedom of expression, the rights to health, the rights to human dignity, and the right to freedom from discrimination. Court hearings began in February 2018. Otieno Namwaya is a researcher at Human Rights Watch. He says the laws, which date from 1930, infringe on LGBT rights and deny them access to medical services or police protection.
Even Kenya's own constitution outlaws discrimination of any kind. So it is illegal to allow discrimination on the basis of religion, on the basis of tribe, on the basis of race, on the basis of sexual orientation. So it is a contradiction for the Constitution to say on the one hand that any form of discrimination is illegal, but on the other we retain laws that actually discriminate against one section of the people.
Irungu Kang'ata is a Kenyan senator and a vocal opponent of gay rights who is also participating in the case. He says if the court strikes down the laws, he and his supporters will seek other avenues to stop what he calls the LGBT agenda.
We either appeal, but I foresee little chances of success in our judiciary, because I strongly believe our judiciary has been captured by non-government organizations. So the best case scenario would be to push for a referendum to amend certain article of the Constitution so that it's very clear that such behavior is not allowed in Kenya.
If the petitioners win, Kenya will be the first country in East Africa to decriminalize homosexuality. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We now leave you with the song Control by Fally Ipupa.
En avant, en avant, en avant, en avant, en avant, en avant, en avant. On regarde pas à gauche, à droite, mais on avance. Non, non, on ne recule pas, mais on avance. On avance, on avance, on avance, on avance, on avance. On les gère, bien on les gère, on les gère. On les traumatise, oui on les sait. Bah ouais, la jalousie est un vilain défaut. Bah ouais, ou bien qu'il faut à la zoba, qu'il faut à la zabré. Mais vraiment, vraiment, il faut à la zoba. Il faut à la zabré. Clé à la main, on active nos armures. On sont guerriers, on intègre, on contrôle.
Nous, nous sommes les élus de Dieu.
On laisse parler les gens.
Et quoi?
Quand tu es bon, tu es bon, ma nègre. Quand tu es nul, tu es nul.
Nous, nous sommes les élus de Dieu.
On laisse parler les gens.
Contrôle.
Quand tu es bon, ma nègre. Contrôle
We have been listening to a test of Fally Ipupa's latest release, Control. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being here. Please join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.